Good evening, everyone.
Good evening. Yeah.
Nice to be back here. Once again, I feel the kind of a very warm, embracing quality of this Zendo. It feels really, really good. And some nice, warm smiles here also. Good to see. Well, I'd like to begin tonight in a rather conventional way. Traditionally, Dharma talks begin with a case from our teaching tradition. And the case tonight I'd like to present is case 45 from the Mumonkan. Hoen asks a question of us, asks a question to his assembly. He says, even Shakyamuni Buddha and Maitreya Buddha are servants of that one, of someone. So I ask you, who is that one? That's it. That's the whole story. Usually these are extended dialogues, a little give and take, a repartee, a little... A question is asked, an answer, and things go back and forth a bit. But in this case, we simply have the question. Who is that one? Even the Buddha, even the awakened being of this time, of this present time, the manifest Nirmanakaya expression of awakening, Shakyamuni Buddha, and the Buddha of the future, the Buddha of the potentiality of the way. Even those two must answer to someone, must be accountable to someone, must be accountable to something. And the question is, who is that one? Who is that thing? What is that thing? At Jikoji, we finished with Buddha's birthday session. It's called Tanjue. Do you have Tanjue here? Do you call it Tanjue? Yeah. And in Tanjue, we went over what's called the four immeasurables. You may know these. The Brahma Viharas, they're called. The divine expressions of the way, and they're also called the apramanas, which means they're immeasurable. Immeasurable in the sense that these qualities or aspects are nothing that you do and then you finish and you complete. They're like, they're unended, you know. You continuously manifest them or function with them. So I think you know, some of you may know these pretty well. The first one is metta, which is called loving kindness. Sometimes it's even translated as just love. metta, and I'm sure you chant the Metta Sutta, we do too as well, so it's common. The second one is Karuna, or compassion, the capacity to hear the cries of the world, like Avalokiteshvara, and respond. The capacity and willingness to be with suffering, your own and others, to take care of suffering. So that's Karuna. The third one is called Mudita. And mudita is, it gets variously translated. I like to translate it just as gladness, as the willingness to be glad, to actually have appreciative joy and a loving concern for other people as well as for yourself. That's mudita. And the fourth one is upeksha, or equanimity, balance, the capacity to look. Thich Nhat Hanh calls it the capacity to look over. In other words, to, instead of like being in a woods where there's a lot of trees and brush in front of you, you look from this high place, you're able to see your whole terrain, you're able to see the various aspects, and to see particularly that they're fundamentally equal, that they're fundamentally the same, and that the opposites of our lives, the dualities of our lives, do not necessarily compete with one another, or are not contradictory. The opposites, it's sometimes classically called the non-contradiction of opposites. So these are the four apramanas that we went over during the session. When we went over them in detail, it was very interesting to try and examine these and try and establish what they were in our daily lives and how they could function. And one of the things that came up that was very important was that these qualities, we often assume that they're something that are sort of there or given to us as a kind of sort of package deal of practice. But we came to understand that more importantly, there's something to actually take up almost as equipment, to take up, to deliberately and effectively take up and intentionally practice, for instance, loving kindness, to deliberately take it up as a decision, as an effective way to meet the world. You could almost say as an assignment, as a practice assignment, to choose to effectively and deliberately practice today meeting this person, mudita, sympathetic joy, and how to do that. We talked about how to do that, and What I've been thinking about after those discussions was how to choose, how to deliberately in our practice, which we think of as something that, in a certain sense, there's a certain passivity or I would say not passivity, but a certain kind of graciousness that we have with the practice itself that we don't often evoke or deliberately intend. We often get in a state where we expect the practice to take care of itself, or we expect loving kindness to manifest in and of itself, or we expect equanimity, this kind of balance to see both sides and to see both sides as equal to happen by itself. But the question comes up, can we deliberately choose to be equanimous? Can we deliberately choose to love, to practice loving kindness? There's a Sanskrit term called cetana, and cetana is variously translated it's translated as choice, to choose. But it also means cetana. These Sanskrit terms sometimes have a very broader meaning than the Western term. So cetana sometimes is understood as the will, the actual energy or power that we have to actually make a choice, to come to choose the good, to choose what is the right thing to do. Cetana also includes what we might call an aspiration, to have a thought, to have to have an understanding that comes forward that says, I will do this. I will practice mudita. I will practice mudita toward this person that is, say, difficult for me. I will feel glad that good fortune has come to this person who really irritates me, or something like that, you know? I mean, you know, it's not easy, these are not easy things to do. But to actually, what's coming forward to me from this discussion about the Brahma Viharas is, can we empower ourselves to actually invoke these positive aspects? And are we willing to do it? Are we willing to step forward and say, I will practice loving kindness. I will actually cultivate it. I will come forward and meet the world with this intention. My teacher, Koban Shino Roshi, I guess you could say he's the founder of this place as well, yeah. Koban Shino Roshi, some of you may know or have heard of him. He often spoke of something called igen in Japanese, igen. And gen means I. And E, the Japanese E, I think literally it means like correct or appropriate. But in this instance, Igen means how he translated as the correct eye, or he translated as bright, the bright eye. The bright eye. The fresh eye. So he he brought this term into his teaching quite a bit, and he said he invoked us to have bright eye, to have bright eye teaching, you know, not somnambulant, spaced out, feel good kind of hang out teaching, but a bright eye teaching, a fresh bright eye. That's called Egan. So he encouraged us to practice in our practice and in our daily life to have bright eyes. So I tend to have actually kind of sleepy eyes myself. So I would have to like stretch my face to, I couldn't do it very well. But I worked on it for a while. That's called Egan, bright eyes. And bright eyes, if you practice with bright eyes, you know, fresh eyes, beginner's mind eyes, ready eyes, rise eyes that are actually curious and interested and ready to meet the world, ready to practice metta, you know, ready to practice equanimity. If you have bright eyes evolves into Hogen, which means the eye of Dharma, the eye that understands truth, understands Dharma. And Hogen means, Hogen can evolve into what's called Taigen, which is oceanic eye, the eye that sees, not just sees particularity, but sees everything, you know, and is interested in everything and is ready for everything. That's Taigen, and Taigen can evolve into what's called Butsugen, Buddha eye. This is the fine why. Butsugen is the eye that understands and sees and shunyata, that sees emptiness, that sees the interconnection of all things and thoroughly enjoys it. About this, topic of choice, of chetana, I'd like to read something from another one of my teachers, Katagiri Roshi. Katagiri Roshi says, You should understand that oneness needs you. Dharma or totality really needs you, whoever you are, wherever you are. This is why we have to deal with it and make it alive. The moment when totality appears in your life is called ki. The Roman G is ki, ki. The moment when totality appears in your life is called ki in Japanese. Ki is variously translated as dynamic working, as functioning or the device of how things function. It means vitalness or vital opportunity. There's a expanded term that's called Zenki. Your teacher's name is Zenki, isn't he? Zenki means, I think, total dynamic functioning, total dynamic working. Katagiri says, we have to return to this first moment of activity. This first impulse or moment of activity, Which is actually what Zazen is. Zazen is first moments. We meet it, and Kadagiri says we meet it, and then he said, no, we have to do more than meet it, we have to pinch it. Isn't that weird? How do you pinch totality? He says, but this is actually very simple, and we're already doing it. So we practice day by day and see that this totality supports our life. There's another Japanese term that I like called shoshoku. And this is a kind of understanding and knowing of this totality. Shoshoku means a kind of intuition or a feeling about something. And the metaphor that's used is like when you receive a letter from home. You haven't been home for a long time and you receive a letter from home. And even before you open the letter, it speaks of home. That kind of understanding is what Kadagiri is talking about. So, who is that one? Even the manifest and functioning Buddha of this present time, and even the potentiality of Buddha's way, in the future, all of that is accountable to someone. When I first got interested in Buddhism, I guess you could say I became very starstruck. You know, I met my teacher, Koban Chino Roshi, and I'd run off from my farm in Wisconsin to do sesshins, and practice with Kadagiri, and I was very idealistic. I thought I was serving something. I thought I was in the service of the Buddha's way. I thought I guess you could say I was practicing more bhakti yoga rather than karma yoga. Strictly speaking, this practice is karma yoga. In other words, the yoga of action, the action of the doing. We're actually doing the same thing that Buddha did. We're doing the actual identical thing that the Buddha did, which he recommended to us. And this is karma yoga. But in the beginning, I was very idealistic, and I was more, oh, my wonderful teacher, and oh, the way, and oh, all this Japanese stuff. It was so interesting and seductive and beautiful, and it was my way in, you know. And for a while I felt like I was working for the Buddha way. But I'd like to throw out, and I don't think that's necessarily problematic, but I'd like to throw out turn that around and say, okay, that's true, but is Buddhism working for me? You know, is Buddhism actually, is the Buddha the Shakyamuni Buddha and Maitreya Buddha, servants of this one, are the original Buddha and the Buddha of the future accountable to me? To my understanding? How audacious is that? But why not ask that question? You know, we only have one life. This is it. We have an embodied consciousness. We have a limited amount of time. I mean, this isn't fun and games. This is serious. This is birth and death, you know? Is Buddhism accountable to me? Is the Buddha accountable to me? Is totality, as Katagiri said, does totality or oneness actually need me? Is it waiting for me? Is it saying, I've been waiting for, what's keeping you so long? Come on. Kokyo and I went to see an interesting Buddhist teacher and philosopher, Jay Garfield, who's written a lot of wonderful books, and Holly's smiling because she's heard him on, I've been listening to the tapes, and he's done a series of tapes that kind of surveys the whole Western and Eastern history about meaning in life, how to find meaning in life. And it's a wonderful survey. Anyway, I became acquainted with Aristotle. And I hadn't read Aristotle before. I just went to art school and didn't read philosophy very much until I got into Buddhism. So I had a very limited scope. So it's wonderful. I was able to go back and study a little bit of Aristotle and Hume and some of the Western philosophers from Jay's survey. And Aristotle talks about what he calls the highest good. The highest good that all the other goods are, in a certain sense, are accountable to. And through his reasoning and through what this famous functioning argument, like the function of a human being is different from the function of a knife. For instance, like the function of a knife is to cut really well, and the function of a, you know, to be sharp and to actually function as a knife. And the function of a collie is to herd sheep. And the function of a doctor is to heal, and so on. So the question comes up, what is the function? What is the function of this human life, of human life? You know? What is the highest function of human life? And basically, it's to know. It's to come to knowledge. It's to come to truth. The highest good from this discourse is virtuous action in accord with wisdom. Or they call it reason, but not necessarily like analytical reason as we understand it, but that there are reasons that we do things. And so it's virtuous action in accordance with reason or wisdom. And the highest good is happiness itself, is simply human happiness. That's the highest good. In Greek, it's called eudaimonia. Eudaimonia is translated usually as happiness, but a better translation, a more common translation for Aristotelian scholars that they use is called flourishing. So the highest good or the purpose of life, according to Aristotle, is to be happy. To flourish, to have a flourishing life, to say at the end of your days, this was a good life. I fulfilled my time here. And I created, obviously happiness, the happiness that he's talking about is not just an incidental emotional feeling, but it's a pervasive sense of having met your life and having brought your life forward with well-being, and you could say accomplished your task of being alive. So I thought that very interesting, that here Aristotle is a scientist and he talks about various obtuse philosophical things, and yet the highest good is simply to flourish, to be happy. I kind of like that. Well, we have in our tradition those famous words to study the Buddha way, or to know the Buddha way. Does this sound familiar? To study the Buddha way, to know the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to disperse or release or forget the self. To release self is to be confirmed by all existence. But in Dogen's Genjo Koan, right before that statement, he says this: there's just the seed of forms and hearing sounds with body and mind as one, and making them intimately their own, and fully knowing them. But this knowing is not like a reflection in a mirror, or like the moon in the water. With the noticing of one side, the other side is in darkness. And then, after that, and it could be interpreted as kind of a switching gears, but I think there's a context, a connection here. Then he says, to learn the Buddha way is to learn the self. To learn the self is to forget the self. So the question that comes up for me is, why did he say this right before to learn the Buddha way is to learn the self? And he said, in a sense, this knowing, this intimacy, this knowing is not like a reflection in a mirror, not like the moon in the water. In other words, this could be interpreted as it's not discursive knowledge. It's not knowledge of. It's not knowledge separate from the experience itself. It's not a model of the thing itself. No, it's not that. It's direct seeing. It's direct understanding. It's direct meeting. So when I'm looking at someone's face, I don't see the back of their head. It's that direct. It's actually direct meeting. There's other interpretations of this light and darkness that have to do with totality and particularity, but this is a kind of different spin on this. It's Dogen is saying, no, it's direct. And then he says, in effect, in other words, it's local. It's immediate. It's your immediate experience. So where do you begin? I'm sort of packing this interpretation between these two sentences. So where do you begin? You begin locally. You begin with what's at hand. And what's at hand? What's at hand?
Your very life.
Your very life. Your body, your mind. So you study yourself, right? You study yourself. You examine yourself. You see what's going on. And even Shakyamuni Buddha in this study and the Buddha of the future are accountable to that study, are in service to that study. You start with yourself. And if you really investigate yourself, you'll see that this self can drop away. And when it does drop away, then everything comes forward and says, what took you so long? I've been waiting for you. That's about as far as I got. even Shakyamuni, Buddha, and Maitreya Buddha are accountable to that one. So, who is that one? There's a Mumma Khan has a little commentary after that, very interesting little commentary that I like. He says about this, he says, Mumman was the compiler of the Mumman Khan. If you clearly recognize that one, it's just like meeting your father at the crossroads, or your mother, or your friend. It's just like meeting your father at the crossroads. It's not necessary to ask if it is him or not. Because, of course, you know it. You know him. It's your father. It's your friend. It's yourself. It's yourself. And you meet, it's very interesting, you meet at the crossroads. You meet at the crossroads. In other words, you don't meet on the highway, you know, cars going by. You meet at the crossroads where you actually stop, where you actually can make a choice about going left and right. Where you actually choose, you can actually choose to practice, choose to meet yourself. I think that's enough. Would anyone like to say anything? Have a question?
I love the pinch. Never heard that. And where I go with that, and it feels compatible with what you're saying, I've thought before about this term agency. You know, because it is
self-agency, maybe?
This whole thing of, you know, it's not working for me. Practice isn't working for me. Oh, I don't feel compassion for that person. As if it was going to just drop out of the sky.
Yeah.
As if it wasn't about this one. You know, so there's something about pinching that feels, has that quality to me of, no, I have to do it. I don't know if that's how you hear the pinch part, but that's how it struck me, just the viscerality of it.
Well, when you just said that, I was thinking how reluctant we are to evoke kind of self-agency, because we're so careful about not to bring ourselves forward, you know, and we're worried about pushing, you know, pushing this whatever this baggage is, this identity is, you know. But to and also, I think when we say I'm going to be more loving, doesn't it sound a little like a setup or artificial? And right away, I would maybe become a little suspicious of the mind that chose to be loving rather than was just loving, you know. Yeah, just, you know. But I think, in a certain sense, I think one of the great virtues of this practice is it frees us from that that stickiness, that we can actually make a wholesome intention, you know, and say I will be a good boy or girl, you know, I will behave myself, I will grow up, I will finally be an adult, you know, tomorrow, not today. Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
Following on that, and since you brought up Aristotle, whom I love deeply, for Aristotle, an ethical virtue is only ethical virtue to the extent that you're choosing it. So we can set ourselves up and have all kinds of good habits to do the right thing.
Yeah.
But you reveal your virtue
in the functioning,
in the matter of having to actually choose to do the right thing. And some things are choice-worthy, according to Aristotle, and other things are not choice-worthy. So he has clear ideas about what the right things to do are, but doing it automatically doesn't put you in the realm of having...
He said some things can be cultivated, and other things can't, you know, that are by nature, like you can't, I think the example he used was like, you can't, by throwing a rock up, you can't train it to float, you know, because the nature of a rock is to fall, you know, so isn't that right? Something like that?
I'm thinking that if you're always spontaneously loving, that's great. And that tells us a lot maybe about what you've done in the past to get to spontaneously loving. But the moments when something big goes down and you have to choose loving kindness in that moment, that's the moment in which you are revealed.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think that...
Yeah. And oftentimes the choices that are made are not clear choices between absolute good and absolute bad, but different... Different types of what might be a good choice, you know, depending on what's appropriate and so on, you know.
Huh. When you mentioned crossroads, the practice is just a long series of crossroads.
To me.
The point where that final crossroads, you make that choice and you are there. It seems to me that there are all those crossroads, including that final one.
Has anyone heard of Terence McKenna?
Who? He's our musician.
Terence McKenna. You've heard of him? Yeah. Yeah, he's kind of a cult science philosopher guy. Yeah. Yeah. Well, he in the context, he has the idea that or the understanding, actually it's the understanding of modern science, that we think of the events of the present moment being precipitated or pushed by the moment preceding it. So like the karma or the event of a moment ago is pushing this moment to exist. But his understanding many scientists are starting to talk about the historical events or how things happen, not as being pushed by past action, but actually there's a what's it called? I wrote it down here. It's a it's being drawn out or pulled by by something called an attractor. Sometimes they call it a strange attractor. So it's an impulse of you could call it of evolution to kind of complete itself, and we're like the forward point of it, being cognitive, and we're not evolving physically anymore, but we're evolving mentally and spiritually and so on. There's this attractor that's actually pulling history, pulling events forward, and that's the energy that's creating. What do they call it? It's moving toward. I have it here. It's called novelty. It's moving toward novelty. In other words, where things are hyper-connected, where there's things are totally unified, all the points are meeting, where there's perfect knowledge. So there's a kind of, sounds a little bit far out, but it's the idea that events, we're being pulled by the future rather than being pushed by the past, you know? Then when we look at those crossroads that we have, are we actually choosing, you know? Or is like the totality itself, you know, pulling us forward, and our best selves are kind of being pulled forward. I don't know. That's out there, but it's interesting stuff.
Interdependent origination.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it connects with interdependent origination. Yeah. 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 Did you have something?
Yeah. Yeah. Would you be willing to leave the terms, the original terms that you were speaking about, in service to and accountable to? Even these Buddhas are in service to, is that the original words, or are they accountable to? I found those to feel very different. And this is a subtlety, but I'd like to revisit it for a moment, if you're willing.
Sure.
It's subtle, but it feels very different.
Even the Buddha and Maitreya are servants of that one. But I think I expanded the interpretation, are accountable to that one, or in service of that one. Is that what you meant?
Yes, those two ideas felt very different.
Uh-huh, yeah.
I'd like to explore that just for a moment. In service to...
What...
Accountable to... Maybe my mind is just...
Well, I could expand it even further. Even Buddha and Maitreya are working for me. I'm the boss and they're my employees. How about that? Does that sound sacrilegious? even all the Buddha Dharma is accountable to this one. This one, that one, that one, that one.
Yes. Yeah,
that's pretty audacious, isn't it? I mean, when we think about the... I think accountable, we have that association when we're kids, you know, like you're accountable to...
I'm holding you accountable.
Yeah.
That.
They're like, so you're disappointing me, you're my son, you're, so you have to
there's
be...
There's a whole construct that comes in there with
yeah.
that. When I think about it in service, there's all this feeling of devotion and the whole reason for being is this.
Yeah.
So then I can go with it. So I just wanted to explore that language for a minute. And what is the original language? Do we know?
We have to go back to the original Chinese, the actual characters. And as far as I know, the Chinese characters are often broadly and variously translated, right? Is that your understanding as well? And there's many interpretations, yeah?
I've always heard that story as servants.
Servants of that one, yeah.
Well, thank you for being willing to explore it because something happened and I couldn't quite put my finger on it. But I think it's more clear now. Thank you.
Anything else?
It's kind of a pastime for tea.
Oh, okay.
So just, it'll only take a second because I just wanted to give some weight to what you said because I have the same reaction. And so to those ideas, I reacted better to the pinch. I needed to chew and digest on that too. So.
Servants
of
that
one.
Traditionally, it's servants of that one, right? Yeah. I think I heard accountable from Paul Haller. I heard a talk on this topic from Paul Haller. And Paul said something to that order. So, we're even Shakyamuni and Maitreya are accountable to this one. That may be a trigger term for some people.
I can just hear Paul's thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, thank Paul. Yeah. Okay. Surpassable, I vow to become.